listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, everyone. Tennis.com podcast once again. Ed McGrogan here with Steve Tigner. Today's podcast, we're going to do this one a little bit differently. I actually want to pay homage to two sort of events that have come and gone now. We will not only get to talk tennis, and we will start with Rome right away, but Steve and I are going to do a little Mad Men discussion here. We both watched a show. The finale just ended yesterday as we're still kind of digesting it a little bit. And I thought I'd pay respect to another podcast I used to listen to, which is also going by the wayside, the BS Report on ESPN with Bill Simmons. He often brought in sport and pop culture. That is yet another, whatever your opinion of him is, that was another enjoyable time of mine that is not with us. So I think we'll bring that over to this podcast. And if you haven't watched a show, you can you probably should avoid it. And if you don't watch a show to begin with, you can just hit stop at that point. So does that sound good to you, Steve?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Mad Men's been around so long, you know, it's been off and on for about 10 years. We should say something about it, I think.
We should. We've every so often bring in some non-tennis discussion here, and when you hold the strings to the podcast, you are entitled to those liberties, exactly. So we'll get to Don and all that in a little bit. We'll start with the leading man in Rome and beyond, and that's clearly Novak Djokovic. It's really seeming that, you know, it's almost feels to me like this is an even more mature version of Djokovic's just exceptional 2011 year. And I don't want to even minimize that by even 1%. That was such a remarkable year. Pretty much won everything except the French Open, and that of course is going to be the goal here now, with, you know, with Djokovic having won every Masters and, you know, Slam. There's only been one this year, of course, up to this point. It's really, as you say, he knows it's his best chance to win Paris, and boy, it's going to be really tough to swallow if he doesn't after what we've seen already.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't, you know, he seems so solid right now. I actually hadn't even thought about what it would be like if he doesn't win this year. I thought his match against Federer was the best match he's played this year. It didn't really, you know, there were none of the lapses in the middle of it, and he didn't even seem particularly nervous to me. He seemed like once he got a break in the first set, he pretty much knew he was going to win. You know, Federer has said that about Djokovic a bunch of times in the past, that once he can swing freely and the nerves are gone, you know, Federer sort of usually feels like it's over. And he sort of got that feeling from the way Federer played in the second set. He could probably see that Novak was really feeling and wasn't going to get nervous and wasn't going to give it back to him the way he did in Indian Wells. So I thought the last two, you know, Djokovic started a little slow during the week with some normal, you know, normal for him kind of three-set wins, running away with a third set. But then against Ferrer, he was very good, very confident, and then even better against Federer. I felt like, you know, there were some shots in the first set that Federer normally, he might intimidate or make Djokovic a little nervous with his attack. But Djokovic, you know, he just seemed like he was ready. He was there. He knew he could get the, you know, he knew he could defend, and then he knew he could sort of turn the tables in the rallies. So, I think the big thing with his chances for the French is that, you know, Rafa's not as good as he has been. Not looking as good right now. So I think Djokovic must feel like, you know, that alone must make him feel like this is my year.
And I think getting wins, you know, he not only comes into the French, you know, unbeaten on clay with really untold confidence. He has wins over Rafa, over Federer in the two tournaments that he wins in Monte Carlo, in Rome. I think it's just yet another reason why it seems like this is such, you know, this seems to be building up to the year for him. I think, you know, getting a win over Federer, you know, I think, you know, it's really seemed like oftentimes it's Federer has gotten in Djokovic's way for things. He did at the French in 2011. He beat him in the semis there to really end his unbeaten run. You know, you may forget that Federer has one of two wins over Djokovic this previous year back in Doha or Dubai. It's one of those two. The other is Karlovic. And, you know, of course, I almost tie it back to just thinking about really Djokovic getting that win over Federer last year at Wimbledon, which was such a big win at the time. And I think I think even now you look back on it and say, you know, you wonder whether Djokovic, you know, would get to this place now without that sort of, you know, really breakthrough win to kind of really reestablish himself as a guy who we're seeing, you know, and certainly if he wins the French Open, develop into one of these all-time, you know, unquestioned one of the all-time great players. And thinking about Djokovic and the French, I think the reason why it's such a topic of discussion that's not going to go away is if he can win the tournament, you know, it puts him in a whole new plane of player with the career slam, and we're getting close to double-digit majors, and the pressure will be, you know, the pressure is going to be immense, but really, you know, what Djokovic can gain from it, you know, you have to kind of expect that pressure.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Djokovic said after this match that he really didn't feel like he needed to raise his game, gear up, do anything special for the French Open. You know, he pretty much seems to know the way he's playing now. He doesn't. If he plays this well, he's going to win it. I also think in the past we've always hear about how tough Nadal is to beat over 3 out of 5 sets on clay. How that, you know, is would be so difficult. I think that's a little overrated. If Rafa goes down 2 sets to love, you know, he's still probably going to lose. But I feel like when you look at Djokovic now, who's going to beat him over 3 out of 5 sets on clay? He's, you know, he to me is the guy who wins the marathons, who wins the sort of wars of attrition. He's the guy who wears the other guys down. So I think that in a way is a help for him.
It does, you know, and it does. I'm picturing in my head if you know, Rafa and Djokovic do happen to collide again, it would seem that you'd have to give the kind of the longer the match goes sort of check mark to Djokovic's side, which really I think you'd always put with Rafa for so many years, and it just it does seem like the tables have been turned in that regard too. You know, for Rafa, takes a loss to Stan Wawrinka in the quarters. You know, much more in many ways such a strange defeat. In that match, Rafa all but had the first set in his grasp, had 4 set points, I believe, at 6-2 in the first set breaker, and just can't put the clamps down on Stan. And, you know, Stan takes and then really just kind of withers away in the second set, which is another sort of, you know, thing we're seeing from Rafa that really, you know, really hasn't been apparent throughout most of his career is kind of when the game has been taken to him, he hasn't always been able to come back with the response, whether it's a good enough response or not. You really saw kind of one-way traffic after such a surprising set there.
Yeah, I thought, you know, this wasn't a good loss for Rafa. Madrid, the loss was so bad you could almost just sort of forget about it, and that's what he said. And he said about the Rome match that he felt like he played well. So I think I almost feel like that's more discouraging. This was a match where he did a lot of the things that normally lead to him winning, that build this momentum for him. He would hit a huge forehand, he would play a great piece of defense and win a point. You know, he'd get himself really fired up, and then he would go on to lose that game, or, you know, eventually lose the first set. And I think it's a case of somebody like Stan, who now has a win over Nadal. he played really well, and he played with this sort of confidence, this a little more confidence. I felt like that he could take some of Nadal's best stuff and still win. That was one of the best matches I've seen Stan play. We'll see whether that's an anomaly and other players simply can't do that, or whether that kind of, you know, as they say, the locker room has sort of shifted with playing Rafa, and people feel like that, you know, they can beat him on clay now, because, you know, it didn't used to be that Nadal could play a pretty good match and still lose in straight sets on clay.
And the thing that we're going to get after all these results here, strictly from a numbers basis, is that, you know, Nadal is indeed going to be seated outside of the top four at the French Open. This is something that for years we've really talked about as a possibility. It was more because of injury and, you know, really not having the chance to accumulate ranking points going into the slams. But it wasn't, you know, of all things, it wasn't an extended layoff that derailed his ranking from where it was. It has just been a patch of poor play by his, you know, obviously incredibly high standards. And, you know, Friday's draws are going to be, you know, on the men's side especially, is going to be, you know, one of the more interesting draws we've had at a Grand Slam tournament in many, many years. It's, you know, the most sort of drama that we've typically seen is, you know, is player X going to be able to play this player in the semifinals or the final? And it's going to go well beyond that now. And, you know, we could be seeing, you know, a Djokovic, a Federer versus Nadal, you know, in the quarterfinals of this tournament. So, you know, there's a lot more drama that's been added just, you know, beyond what we've seen here in Rome, Madrid going into Paris.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of Nadal's lower ranking is that he was out later in the year last year. But you're right that he hasn't been as good, you know, even this year when he's come back. He had a chance to get back into the top four, and he hasn't done it. I don't think they should move his seating up. It does throw things off whoever he has to play in the quarters. You know, the other side is helped a lot, but I don't think you do it just because he's won in the past without a, you know, just sort of a one-off change. And also because, you know, he isn't playing the best. It's not as if he's playing the best clay court tennis in the world. You know, he just lost to Wawrinka. He just lost badly to Murray. You know, it's not outrageous to think he's number seven. Of course, it's the French Open, and you know, if he's going to win, he's probably going to have to play Djokovic anyway, even if he plays him in the quarters of the final. So you know, it does unbalance the draw, but I think it's okay to keep him where he is.
Yeah, like I said, only Wimbledon is really affording those subjective seedings. You know, there's a little bit of a formula that goes into it, but, you know, didn't expect that from Paris, and I'm glad we're not going to see it. It's gonna add really just another wrinkle to, you know, a very big French Open for a number of players here. You know, as we talk of the French Open, you know, for the women's side, you know, after Madrid and Rome, you know, there's more than the Serena Williams as the clear favorite narrative. Even though it would be, I think, pretty hard to argue that she still is the clear favorite. Of course, it doesn't really matter. I think a lot of these matches do get settled, sort of beyond our discussions of them. But the past 2 weeks we've seen Petra Kvitova win in Madrid, Maria Sharapova win in Rome, two players that, you know, are certainly have shown what they've done at these specific tournaments in the past, and have just brought them to bear once again in 2015 here. Sharapova taking this title after really kind of a strange sort of dip in form after her run in Melbourne. A little bit of that was injury-based, but Sharapova really right in time kind of brings herself back into discussion, and it's only thing that she does because she's been, you know, essentially one of the top two clay court players in the world for the past 4 or 5 years now.
Yeah, she, you know, I think this is a match, the win over Suarez-Navarro on Sunday that will help her, not because of her form. She doesn't you know, I don't think she really, and she even said she really didn't feel like she played well until the very end when the match was basically over. But these were the kind of matches that she won at the French Open last year, losing the first set, winning a close second set, and then winning the third, really winning a match maybe she shouldn't have won just because of her sort of persistence. And she, you know, she won a bunch of those at the French last year, and she won this, that, you know, that may get her back in that, in that mode, but I feel like she's going to need to play better than she played in that final. Overall, though, you're right. The Serena, you know, obviously there are questions around her now. She had to pull out of Rome. She got beaten badly by Kvitova in Madrid. And that, that match actually reminded me a lot of the match she lost at the French last year to Muguruza. And you also have to throw in Kvitova now. You know, you never know what's coming with her, but she showed that she could, she can win the French Open. It's definitely a possibility. Sharapova is a possibility. These are two people who have won Grand Slams in the last year who are now, you know, have won big tournaments coming in the French. So you have to look at that. You have to look at that as those two players as more of a threat than a lot of the others.
And, you know, the other threats that we talk about, yeah, I think it was, you know, fitting in some ways. You get that Suarez Navarro Halep matchup. And it goes pretty deep, and it was a good one. You know, these two, you know, obviously neither has won a slam before. Halep, runner-up last year at the French. Suarez-Navarro really kind of continuing to build upon sort of a mid-career, you know, where she's really realizing her potential. And, you know, both players, you know, the thing with each of them is that I think a lot of people are going to have a tough time getting out of their head is that, you know, both these two on the biggest stages against the biggest players have been humbled pretty badly. And that's the only, and that's really the thing that, you know, if we're talking about where we want to position these two in terms of French Open threats, bona fides for the title, you know, they're going to be seated very high, but, you know, when all the money's in the table and you put Sharapova up against one or you put Serena up against another, you know, do you really have the faith that a Suarez Navarro or a Halep can break through and get that massive win, you know, to eventually lead to the biggest title?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the women's side, the slams are different. The big hitters win the slams, Kvitova, Sharapova, Serena, Azarenka, and they, you know, that's who wins at those events. That those players who can create their own winners. Halep can do that, but she always plays on an edge because she doesn't have the, you know, the height or the sort of the size or power, natural power. Suarez Navarro obviously doesn't do that. She plays with a lot of spin. She's a great clay courter, but she can't take over a match. She can have it taken from her the way Sharapova did and the way obviously Serena always did. So those are two great players to watch. You know, they played a great match in Rome. They're going to, you know, you have to figure they're going to be there in the second week. But I just feel like if Serena and Maria or Petra or Vika are around and playing well, I think you favor them at a Grand Slam. But they're definitely a great addition to, you know, to the sort of top ranks in the second week at the French.
And you know, we've talked a lot about Serena and where things are and with her, and you know, it wasn't until the Open last year that that she put aside really a string of three consecutive kind of early exits for her at the Slams. Takes the first Slam this year. But it's not unreasonable, I don't think, even with what seems like has been kind of putting those majors from 2014 in the rearview mirror. You know, it really doesn't seem like she, to me, has, you know, it seems like that is what we still could get from Serena, is that sort of, you know, head scratcher type of loss. You know, not against, by no means against an opponent that isn't capable because of her talent to beat someone like Serena, but it's certainly not of the realm of question that, you know, on a surface where, you know, compared to hard courts, Serena's had most of her, you know, the most trouble in her career, that, you know, we could see really that slip up again at some point. And you know, I think this comes into your head kind of just on the heels of really 2 weeks where we haven't seen Serena in the final, but it's something that I don't think can necessarily be discounted either. And you know, as you've written before about Serena, it's not as if she, you know, she's kind of aware of at the point in her career that she's in, is that, you know, she can still be winning titles and winning matches, but not winning it to her, you know, absolutely sky high, you know, thoughts of how she should be playing. It's almost a goal that she can never reach, in a sense.
Yeah, I had thought, you know, I've heard her a lot this year talk about how she didn't feel like she was playing well, even while she was winning every match this year. So I sort of discounted the way she talked about her clay court game after the Fed Cup. You know, she said she wasn't ready, that it was a big wake-up call, that she needed a lot of work on clay. So I sort of thought, well, she's just the way she talks now, and she'll be fine. But she was right. You know, she almost lost to Azarenka in Madrid. She didn't play well at all against Kvitova. And she, you know, she sort of said, "I told you so." And I'm behind in the clay court preparation for whatever reason. So now you sort of think, you know, you feel like it's going to be tougher, a little tougher than normal for her to catch up again, and really feel like she can dominate at the French Open. I feel like this is a tournament where, if you go by how she's been playing and what she's been saying, that she has a little more vulnerability going into the event. You don't feel like that it would take a real crazy, you know, a loss wouldn't be as stunning as you know, sometimes as it usually is for her.
Right. Yeah, we'll see the draws for both men's and women's on Friday. We'll have a lot on both of those. Some picks. Steve will break down the draws. During the French, I should also mention, we'll have a lot. We'll have daily reports really on the matches, and some previews going into each day as well, among other coverage too of Roland Garros. So there's a lot to that will be discussed and that we will discuss here on tennis.com. Please keep in touch with that. And so with that noted, without further ado, let's make our way to Mad Men here. And like I said, if you haven't watched the finale, if you're planning to, you probably should watch it now instead of listening to us talk about it. But I guess I'll start, you know, Steve, with just kind of where my experience with the show and why I think it's worth talking about is I just, every episode for me, in a way, one thing I appreciate about this show is that it's really, you know, it's really almost cinema in a sense that's been put on TV. I think it's that well thought of, produced over the years. I think, you know, you can obviously argue, you know, times of the show that, you know, have been its golden era. You know, certainly these last few seasons, they're a distinct departure from where the show began. You know, the timeline of the show bringing itself from the beginning of the 60s, you end it right at the beginning of the 70s. And I just always thought, from really an artistic point of view, it's really a show that has kind of, you know, I think rewarded a lot of viewers who have taken the time to invest in it as much as the show's producers have done. I think a lot of what you see online written about it, some of it can kind of be overkill. It's almost, you know, it's almost become its own little side industry about it, is not just the show itself, but what we think about the show after. It's kind of like the Monday, you know, the MMQB, but it's the Mad Men Monday Morning Quarterback. It's kind of taken a life on its own. And, you know, there's a lot to talk about from the finale as well, but I just kind of want to get your thoughts on really this series overall, and, you know, what you think, you know, if you think it's really one of the best shows out there, because I do think it is.
Yeah, I think I've always liked it a lot. It's a lot like The Sopranos. You know, the chief writer of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner, he came from The Sopranos. It's sort of, Sopranos started as a kind of a gripping drama, and then, sort of went off in different tangents. Sometimes it felt like it got slow. It got away from where it originally was, but it was always, it was always artistic, always sort of literary. You know, it felt like, like you said, like a short story or like a film. I feel like the downside to Mad Men was the time in between the seasons, because by the last season, I'd forgotten a lot of. Suddenly, somebody would appear from three seasons ago, and even that happened last night, and I would wonder who that person was, and sort of gave up. I feel like if it had been done, if I watched it all as a binge watch, and maybe I would get more out of it, or would like it more. I think I felt like the finale was good, especially the last half an hour, what they did with Peggy and Don's resolutions. And even down to the very end, the very last thing that happens, I thought was good. What did you think of the finale, and what did you think of the very end? What was your interpretation?
Well, I do think that the ending shot of, first of all, I think was kind of a little worried, really almost up until the last few moments of. I think there's this tension that you have when you watch a show that you enjoy and that you really kind of want to see stick that landing, because, for better or worse, it's kind of judged. And this is a show where I think it's better to really take it in its totality, but a lot of it is going to be judged in how you finish it, and it's really the lasting images of, the last images, I should say, of it. And so to see kind of, To see Don, at this commune, really, in a way, with really only about 20 minutes of the show left, and you're kind of wondering, where does this all, how does this all really add up together? And then, but I thought that the last, 10 minutes especially there, I think it paid off a lot from this half season itself, and also really this specific show where, systematically, Don has been kind of stripped of really anything that's really meant anything to him over most of the show's lifetime. And when you get to the last scene, and you see Don kind of meditating there in a mourning stance, and you're like, okay, you can kind of see the show's point of where he goes, and then you get thrown for a loop. About a second later, when this famous Coca-Cola ad comes on, and that adds, really almost a whole new sort of discussion as to, did this really amount to anything for Don, or is it really just more a commentary on the characters, on the era, the times, and I think that sort of ambiguity, because I don't think Matt is ever going to really tip his hand considerably one way or another, but it is hard to even though it's really kind of on the nose, it says, well, maybe, obviously it would lead you to believe that Don in fact at some point did create this iconic, amazing advertisement, but it, on the other hand, it is hard to think that this journey that they put him through, and this, these scenes that John Hamm does as Don, that they didn't amount to anything either. Like, I think really the discussion sort of is eternal with this and continues. And I think whatever way you slice it, it kind of works, which is the one thing I did really like about the ending. Cause a lot of people have, different points about it. And I think, any of the stories can kind of make sense if you defend it well enough.
Yeah, I think it was a good ending. I think, some people have said that means Don wrote that ad. Some people said it just indicates the world that he left. I feel like it indicated that Don and Peggy wrote the campaign together. Of course, they didn't in real life. That was, you know, it's an odd thing to he was, you know, Wiener was asked whether he would have them write, have them in the show write a real campaign. He said he would never do that, or a really famous campaign. But it seems that he did. It seems to me that it indicates Don and Peggy, the way it ended, came back and wrote it and created it together. That would be the way I would think. But some people think it's Don. Some people think it's Peggy. It seems to me that the conversation they have at the end, when he calls her and he starts by saying, you know, some of the awful things that he's done, he sort of admits all the things he's done through the course of the series. She says, come home. And he says at the end, he says, see you soon. In a right. way, it seems like those two needed each other. The show is really about them. They were the sort of core of the show, as Peggy becoming the new Don. I feel like it brought them together. You know, this ending brought them together. As Peggy, at the beginning of the last episode, Pete tells her that she's going to be famous. So people are going to say that someday people are going to say, I worked with Peggy Olson. And she almost leaves McCann. She has to make a decision. She's convinced by her boyfriend, the guy who becomes her boyfriend, that this is what she does well. She was made to do this at McCann. So it seems to me that they're pointing towards a real future for her. And they show her at the end sort of working, you know, sort of the opposite of Don. Don gets the idea from not working, from traveling, from almost committing suicide. And she's the person who almost works too much. So in a way, to me, it means they need each other. And that's what the ad indicated. That's my way of looking at it anyway.
And Stan, who is Peggy's boyfriend, as you mentioned, does say that about Don, that he always comes back. And he's a survivor. There are some very strong hints about that, as kind of the way that you put it there. I thought, overall, it's a, was it like my favorite episode of the show? No, I don't think so. It definitely wasn't. In fact, it was, I think, like I said, this is an episode where it's really best put alongside all of the lead up that they've built towards it. And I think that, the series has, you could have actually, in my opinion, and I've seen people write this as well, that the penultimate episode where Don is left, without a car on a highway in Oklahoma, just kind of on his lonesome with this grin, after again sort of removing himself from really most connections to his past, you could have almost seen that prior episode for him and for many other characters as the end of the series, and it would have worked. And so in the week leading up to this finale, I was curious more than anything as to what would they do, because I really was sort of in a way satisfied at that point. I thought that was a strong episode, and I thought the one that preceded that one was as well. And Mad Men has had a good run of season finales over its past few years. I think, a lot of people agree that it's a show that sort of needs the time to start to warm up and generate, but usually the payoff is there. And I think that's really what this was too. You can kind of get bogged down the details of this one, and that does make for a lot of fun reading and a lot of really good armchair talk. But overall, I think it's hard to argue with how the show sort of pulled it off, and it's really something that I'm still kind of have in my head today, and I think that on its own maybe says it did its job.
Yeah, I think it was a better ending than The Sopranos, which I liked but was very ambiguous, just cuts off. And then I thought it was a better ending than Breaking Bad, which was a good last episode, but I felt like it was a little bit unsurprising. It was a little bit what you thought was going to happen. This was a surprise, and yet it was a little bit of a feel-good element, and it wasn't totally ambiguous. So I feel like this was the best.
You're really left with what seems like a couple of different pathways, and all of them in a way seem to be plausible at least, but it's really left up from that point on for you to decide, I think.
Right.
Yeah. I guess now I'm looking for just, you know, perhaps a new show at some point. It is going to be in a sense odd to not have this for a little while. Then again, I have the Rangers and of course plenty right. of tennis coming up in the next few months. But I did have to get your thoughts in there. We were talking about it earlier this morning, you know, on email, and you did bring up that sort of combined Peggy and Don theory there, and I think that's I think ultimately of all the possible ways you can kind of think of how the show should go, it's a particularly satisfying ending when you see how and I thought really like Elizabeth Moss overall just showed just some, you know, from start to finish really kind of elevated herself in the acting world is, you know, this is going to be the role that's, I would have to think, defines her, you know, almost wherever she goes, just as, you know, it'll be interesting to see where a lot of these, you know, actors end up going, because it's, you know, when you see Jon Hamm on a movie screen, it's almost impossible to get, you know, to remove Don Draper from your head. And that really happens with, you know, so many different, you know, in any show or any movie, it's kind of like, you know, what is next? And I think, you know, after a show that has been as celebrated and as, I think, lauded as this one, you know, that's probably a good problem to have in some ways.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Peggy ending, you can probably, there are different versions of what people thought of the Don ending, but I think everybody thought the Peggy ending was really well done. The phone conversation in the same office scene, and I thought she was really good in that. And I think the other question to me is, what does Matthew Weiner do? You see David Chase, the guy, the Sopranos creator. I don't know what he's done since. I feel like it's also tough to come back from something this involved, creation this involved.
It's especially for him, because it's, you know, not only a show that took, I think, almost a decade to run its course on TV, but I think from what I have read of his, you know, genesis of the show, it started, you know, is probably 7 or 8 more years in the making before it even got to this point. This is really, you know, kind of the magnum opus, the life's work of what he'll do. And you know, as I would say, as Bert Cooper would say, bravo to all
and
that.
I've heard he's going to talk about the ending one time in an interview at the New York Public Library sometime soon, which is a couple blocks from me. Maybe I'll go check it out. But that's
please do.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Like I said, I'd be surprised. I'm curious to see what he says, but I would not be surprised if not that much is said as well. And we will see. Anyways, good Mad Men Monday talk, the first and the last one, unfortunately. But we will resume regular podcasting next. We'll get back to you on that. It could be any number of things, because we have a lot to discuss when the draws come out, and we'll get to that on the podcast, on the site, etc. So follow us, tennis.com, Ed McGrogan and Steve Tigner. Thank you again for listening to the podcast.
You've been enjoying the tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to tennis.com.